bird note. M. DeBlas has years of experience leading bird outings in Chicago. But M. first started birding when they were 19, while visiting family near San Luis Potosí in Mexico.
My mom had gifted me a pair of binoculars because that's something outdoorsy people like. And I had always been an outdoorsy person. So I was just outside of my abuelita's house, and the first bird that perches up is this bright red tiny little bird that's flying a very specific way. And I get my binoculars on it, and I'm like, oh, wow, cool.
It was a vermilion flycatcher, a red bird totally unlike the northern cardinals they knew from Chicago. And that got M curious.
I was also thinking to myself, well, I know that birders like to hear them as well. Maybe they have their own unique calls. So I go on Google, I'm like, vermilion flycatcher bird song. And it's a very, very beautiful whistle, and it is very distinct. So the next day I get out there and I listen for that specific sound, then I hear it all over, and it gives you this added layer into how you experience nature. And then I was like, okay, well then what does a curved-billed thrasher sound like? What does the white-winged dove sound like?
Today, you'll find M sharing their joy on bilingual outings with Chicago BIPOC birders, the Chicago Ornithological Society, and the Urban Birding Festival. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We are rooted in community support and engagement. Thank you for helping us stay on air.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Hale, and with me, as per usual, is Brandon.
I'm looking forward to discussing a paper that you shared with me on epistemic trespassing, a sort of concept of experts going beyond their, well, field of expertise to try and venture questions that they may or may not be authorized to answer. As philosophy students, I think we have the sort of training to be able to go into these kinds of questions. So it'll be interesting to see what we get out of them.
But this is a very contemporary epistemological work. Nathan Ballantyne and his paper, Epistemic Trespassing. Nathan Ballantyne works at Fordham University, and he wrote this paper a few years ago. And it's a really interesting look at how we justify forming particular rational beliefs and some systemic problems with what we might call expert opinion in the, you know, political and social world. But before we do that, do we want to jump in with a little quote and quandary to get things kind of warmed up? I've got a little quote for today, which I thought was interesting. I've been working on a university course on geography, and I was doing a course section on maps, and I found this quote that was really interesting. So this is specifically about, obviously, when we think about maps, we think about the, you know, 2Dification of, you know, our 3D world into some, you know, a location and space that we can then interpret and understand in a particular way. But the author, John Monomer, wrote the book called Lying with Maps, and he has this quote from the book, which goes as thus: not only is it easy to lie with maps, it's essential. To portray meaningful relationships for a complex three-dimensional world on a flat sheet of paper or a video screen, a map must distort reality. There's no escape from the cartographer paradox. To present a useful and truthful picture, an accurate map must tell white lies. Because most map users willingly tolerate white lies on maps, it's not difficult for maps to tell more serious lies. Map users seldom, if ever, question, and they often fail to appreciate the map's power as a tool of deliberate falsification or subtle propaganda. To think about how maps are always going to be on some level a lie. And I mean, when you really think about it, that's obviously correct, because maps aren't a literal one-to-one representation of a particular space.
This is interesting, right? Because a map is a representation. So to say that, okay, we've got a one-to-one representation would be to have a 3D model in space that is the same proportions, the same size. It has the same like properties, so it's made of the same stuff. It even would have like the same acoustic properties. That would just be the thing. The map that is one-to-one would just be the very thing that you're trying to depict. So it has to be a representation which is proportionate to that thing. So it's scaled down in proportion to, like, say if you have a building model, it preserves those kind of that scale or that that height, shares the relationship to the surrounding place, but it's meant to be kind of like handheld, right? That's what it is. It's a representation. It's not the thing itself. And it allows you, the other thing too, is that a map allows you to do something with it, right? It allows you to navigate the thing that it is trying to represent. So it doesn't necessarily have to have those same, you know, if it has those, what he's calling white lies, which I think is interesting, I would kind of like, I would want to deconstruct the idea of a lie, because a lie is a deception, right? And a deception is when you're trying to get something out of someone or take advantage of someone. I don't know, maybe cartographers are particularly, are like heavy profiteers and they're trying to sell their maps really well, but it's more a semblance or it's more a necessary illusion in a certain way, where those are just the gaps that open up between representation and thing represented that allow a map to do what it does.
Yeah, and I think the aspect of, you know, choosing the term like a lie or white lie is certainly an interesting choice by the author. But I know that a part of it comes from the fact that, like, you know, a map is made by a cartographer, whatever the map is, and that cartographer has to pick and choose what symbolic representations are important and which are not important, right? So in that sense, I think, you know, that's part of the kind of lie is, you know, in the objective plane, whatever we can call that, you know, things are just kind of there. There's a field, a river, a farmhouse, there's a forest, blah, 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 blah. But the map might only show the river and the forest because, you know, this cartographer has decided that those are the only relevant aspects of the environment, of the location, to this particular map. But that's a choice, and it's a choice to exclude other elements, right? And by also excluding other elements, it's a choice to elevate others as well, into making them kind of relevant or seem important or whatever it might be. So yeah, I think it's always interesting to look at something like a map, because we do have this tendency to just sort of, like, you know, trust and assume, oh, it's a map, right? Like, it's, you know, it's a representation. But sometimes we forget, like, representations are always representations because they've been created. They are representative. Yeah, exactly. The contracts are representative by someone for someone. And in that sense, they might be accurate in some ways, but their accuracy is always formed from a certain level of subterfuge or inaccuracy.
Yeah, it's a kind of selective accuracy in a way. That was interesting. I should say, too, maybe the other reason that the author uses the term lie is because as soon as you said the title of that book, it made me think of the book How to Lie with Statistics. So maybe they're kind of playing off that and trying to preserve the lie in the title, which is kind of an interesting, I mean, there's maybe something you could say about that as well, but not necessarily on the last episode, but in the last episode where we brought up our quandary, I had this question about the purpose of advertising, right? I like to think about advertising because it's so ubiquitous. It's a very like fish in water kind of phenomena. So it feels very in-depth when you can think about advertising. And it was this question about the ubiquity of Coca-Cola advertising, and the fact that if the purpose of advertising is to inform people, why would Coca-Cola continue to advertise and market its product despite it being one of the most ubiquitous commodities on earth? In fact, it's so ubiquitous that I think you corroborated this pretty well, that in foreign languages the word for a carbonated soft drink is just cola, it's like the word okay. It's kind of attained a sort of self-sustaining linguistic presence in the world. So the question becomes, why does Coca-Cola still have one of the most expensive marketing budgets on the planet? So my question my quandary for today kind of continues on that. And it notices that, like, in response to my attempted answer to why Coca-Cola continues to do what it does, which was that it's not just trying to continuously refresh our memories that are always sort of in the process of forgetting, but is actually constructing the social spaces or constructing the social meaning within which you can desire it, right? Because desire is always mediated by what other people want, and that it's kind of inherently social in that way. It's to notice a contrast between that kind of advertising that seems like nonsensical. Like, if you look at a Coca-Cola ad, it's not really like telling you its price. It's not telling you that it tastes a certain way. It's not telling you where you can get it. It's not telling you how it's made or where it's made. It's not trying to really inform you of anything. It's kind of just putting down a vibe. It's just like, hey, if you drink this, you'll be cool. Or if you drink this, you'll be enjoying yourself. Or hey, if you drink this, you'll have a good time with your family over the weekend or something like that. I put it sort of next to what I call innocent advertising, which is what people think advertising is when they tell themselves, oh, you know, we're telling, you know, advertisers are trying to inform you something.
Yeah, like Swiffer gets rid of 99.9% of bacteria or whatever on your counters.
Yes, stuff like that. But that's more like an appeal to our reason. But innocent advertising is the quintessential example of this is the flyer. So you go to the store and the first thing you see is like this very disposable newsprint that has pictures of the things that they are selling, their price, and usually that they are on sale, right? I consider this innocent advertising because it's not doing the social engineering that fantasy advertising is doing. A flyer is not trying to construct your desire, right? It is really trying to just tell you, like, hey, we got this thing and it's on sale. And in a certain way, it's almost cute, you know, compared to like modern advertising. And that's why I call it innocent. I don't know if it's as innocent or at least as like harmless as fantasy advertising, but I'm noticing like a very stark contrast in the ways that advertising can be worked here. And I guess my quandary is like, okay, well, if advertising when it's like most utilized is this fantasy construction of desire, why is innocent advertising even a thing? Like, I get maybe it is already trying to take advantage of a kind of immediate desire to opportunistically sell you something on the buck that it's just for sale, and you can sort of take advantage of people's impulses by offering it for them cheaper, and it sort of lowers this threshold for a very quick purchase. In that regard, it's not innocent, right? It's taking advantage of your impulses, but it's innocent in comparison to the very deliberate engineering that goes on in the fantasies of fantasy advertising.
Yeah, I think I really like that, how you kind of made that distinction between innocent and fantasy. And I do think on some level, innocent advertising to me, not only does it feel kind of old school, but it also, like you kind of hinted at, it feels very practical. You know, you kind of walk into the store and you know, maybe perhaps you're going in there for dish soap. And guess what? There's a banner up for dish soap and it's 50% off, right? They're trying to inform you there's a product here, it's accessible. You know, maybe they're trying to trick you into thinking it's some sort of deal, but it's letting you know about that product. Clearly the fantasy advertising, whether it's Coca-Cola, but I can also think of other easy ones, like something like Disney or whatever, they're selling you it's an icon. It's the maintenance of this iconic, you know, sort of position. That is what the advertising is for on some level, right? Like, it's not like they're trying to sell people Coca-Cola. They're continuing, at least in my interpretation, is continuing to remind people that Coca-Cola is not only a product, it's a hyper relevant pillar of culture. Don't forget about Coca-Cola. it's super important. No one needs to like be told to buy a Coke or not. They just need to be reminded of the story. And I like how you use the term fantasy, because it's kind of like, it's continuing the maintenance of like a narrative rather than pointing, you know, symbolically about information.
As the internet intrudes into relations and we become more and more fragmented and isolated, especially literally when things like the COVID pandemic happened and people had to literally isolate, there was this trend in advertising where buying a product was advertised as promising you time with family. You very much so see this trend of images of people getting around the table and having, you know, dinner, or sitting around the TV and you're spending time with kids and stuff like that, and you're spending time with family, or you can invite your friends over. So it's selling you this fantasy of, hey, this thing will give you this situation. It'll allow you to have this experience. And it's in that way that it is kind of a fantasy, because obviously, you know, those things have to be like maintained by, you know, actual social interaction and stuff like that. You can't just go out and buy a Coke and then everyone wants to come over.
Disney is obviously a totally ubiquitous name and company and organization. But they also, like, they really emphasize this sort of, like, family activity and family involvement. The dark side of Disney that you hear more and more people talking about is the fact that, like, it's extremely expensive to do these things. Like, the fantasy is real. It's super important. You should be participating in this, even if it actually drains you of, like, your resources and time that could be put towards other more sustainable forms of familial and social interaction.
If like we watched a Disney movie and it actually facilitated some kind of discussion or something like that, where we actually are like communicating with each other, it seems that in a lot of these kinds of cases, they take a substitute for the actual like relationship that you form with people who you engage with this stuff with. I don't know. I think that maybe video games are like another good example of this, where it's like, you know, we play video games together and we're friends in that kind of sense. That doesn't necessarily always translate to having like a close personal relationships or developing those relationships. It's just like, oh, every weekend we play video games or something like that. And it doesn't get much farther than that. And if you try and challenge or go beyond playing games together or like engaging in media like Disney or whatever, that almost seems to violate the relationship you've built up. I think Aristotle would say that you've formed a friendship of pleasure thinking that you've formed a friendship of character, and friends are most at odds when they don't have the kinds of friendship that they think they have, right? Because they can't give each other what they want.
With that kind of contradiction in mind, do we want to jump into our main topic for today that we kind of hinted at the beginning of the episode or talked about briefly?
Yeah, let's talk about epistemic trespassing.
Yeah, I think this is a really fun topic for us and for listeners, because it's an example of a like really contemporary work. Like, I think like people have a tendency to think philosophy is very kind of like, it, you know, stingy and dingy and old, and, you know, we're just working on old books and tomes and ancient writers and thinkers and blah, blah, blah. But there are people out there doing new and kind of interesting work. And Nathan, say that last name again.
I'm reading it as Nathan Ballantyne.
Ballantyne, yeah. So Nathan Ballantyne has really come up with an interesting sort of idea of his own. I'm just going to read the opening definition that he puts forward. So for this is his title. It's for the paper called Epistemic Trespassing. And epistemic trespassing is an idea that he's kind of come up with here, or term. He says, epistemic trespassers judge matters outside their field of expertise. Trespassing is ubiquitous in the age of interdisciplinary research, and recognizing this will require us to be more intellectually modest. And then just to jump real quick into the first paragraph of the introduction, epistemic trespassers are thinkers who have competence or expertise to make good judgments in one field, but move to another field where they lack competence and pass judgment nevertheless. We should doubt that trespassers are reliable judges in fields where they are outsiders. So right there, we get like the first kind of intro to this term and idea of epistemic trespassing within the field of epistemology. And it's really about, simply put, it's you know, about, you know, thinking that because you have, you know, expertise in one field or area, you can pass suitable, rational, and justifiable judgments in another field. And this is a phenomena that I think we see a lot of today in particular.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Especially considering the, you know, we had to make it about media, especially considering the present media conditions that we exist in, where everything is related to everything and everyone is involved with everything. If you can bring in someone who has an air of authority, it doesn't quite much matter to an audience who's not versed in a particular field whether that authority is well-founded or not. I mean, I think case in point, not a particular case, but bringing on scientists to talk about like philosophical concepts or something like that, it plays well to an audience who wants to hear something spoken with an air of authority. But we, as you know, students of philosophy and philosophers, know that it's not it doesn't have the actual credibility that matches the authority, because the competence is not the same kind of competence, right? Nathan opens with a couple examples, and his pet example throughout mostly is Linus Pauling, who was a chemist, and he won two Nobel Prizes, one for chemistry and the other for activism against atomic weapons. But he then later went on to advocate for mega doses of vitamin C to treat a wide range of problems. Now, obviously, this is a case of epistemic trespassing, because even though Linus Pauling is an award-winning chemist and activist, he is not a competent doctor or nutritionist to talk about the relationship between vitamin C and the mechanisms of illness for particular kinds of diseases and stuff like that. So even though he's award-winning and can talk about all kinds of different subjects with legitimate authority, right? This is the important thing, is that Linus Pauling does have legitimate authority, but he transfers that authority to an area where he doesn't have authority, and that's because of his competence. He's competent in one area and he's incompetent in another, but the transference of that authority looks legitimate, even though it is not.
Yeah. And I think, you know, going back to epistemic or episteme, like, again, this is about like knowledge, and knowledge as in like true belief. And so trespassing is like this idea of trespassing on true belief. And there's different ways that different people justify that. Now, I think the scientist example is a very good one, because epistemic trespassing does have a lot to do with social conditions as well. And I'm sure we'll talk about that. But people tend to trust scientists, right? People see them as smart, and in many cases they see themselves as smart as well. I think that's also a very important point. And so therefore they're fit to judge. But there's also like more, I think, obvious forms of epistemic trespassing that like are just like more people would generally recognize right away, I would hope. But like one of the most obvious examples I think about is like celebrities, like particularly actors and people like that, who like, you know, have opinions on, you know, maybe scientific matters or complex political issues or whatever. And it's like, you're an actor. Like, why why would anyone trust what you have to say about this? And I think in many cases, the reference to that is not so much their credentials, but fame. People have a tendency to just like believe people who are well known just by virtue of the fact that they are well known, not because they have justified reasons for their beliefs. The scientist example is interesting because obviously some scientists are obviously famous, but there's this tendency to just believe in scientists because, again, you know, they're scientists, they're smart. Of course they should know, right? Like, but, you know, as Nathan like points out, and paper like, you know, goes into it, I'm sure we'll talk about more, but like, there's many, many different fields of study in this world, right? There's many areas of logos. Logos is all over the place. And just because, you know, I know lots about, say, geography, doesn't mean that I suddenly know lots about high-level mathematical theory, right? Like, those things don't necessarily translate. But, you know, it's easy to cross, you know, get your lines crossed effectively is what this whole paper is kind of about.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's really important to note too that it can seem like that even from the perspective of a person who is trying to be cognizant of something like epistemic trespassing. I think the geography example actually works pretty well because geography, you know, as far as like laying out maps, maybe as we were talking about before, or plotting out relations between certain spaces, might actually have something to do with mathematics. Geography might involve some kind of mathematics. Again, maybe I'm doing a little trespassing here by making that assumption, but in my head, I can imagine mathematics being relevant to the calculation of proportions for the representation of space, right? So not necessarily the bulk, but a large portion of the paper is devoted to this cross-relation between things and the way that we can get our wires crossed. It's the articulation of how expertise can get kind of trespassed upon by people who do have legitimate, who are pursuing questions that do have this cross-field subject matter, right?
Yeah, and I think you made an interesting point, which is, you know, the people who do on some other level have relevant subject matter. Epistemic trespassing is one of those things where it's like, look, I think all of us could easily do it, but it's really only relevant as a serious vice when it's backed up with other notable accolades or you know, areas of substantial knowledge, right? So what I mean by that is like, look, if some guy who's just say kind of a little bit wacko and out there and not really a professional or anything and just like has opinions on all sorts of stuff, is that person epistemically trespassing? Like maybe kind of, but I don't really think that's the focus. I think the focus of this whole idea is people who have relevant, justified, and strong areas of epistemic knowledge in one or other schools, shifting over and using that actual knowledge as a justification to uphold beliefs in an area where they don't have relevant knowledge and understanding, right? Like this, the process really only makes a lot of sense or is relevant when you can kind of fool others and yourself with your credentials effectively.
Yeah, essentially, because there is, I mean, not to get to the end, but Nathan himself is quite ambivalent about the place of epistemic trespassing. He does think that interdisciplinary research is a good thing. It allows us to collaborate and to answer questions that we wouldn't otherwise be able to answer alone. So something like epistemic trespassing has to be possible responsibly. And also just from the study of philosophy, I mean, historically, if you look at philosophy, it's always been a kind of unifying subject matter, right? I think one of the great things about philosophy is its aspiration to synthesize all kinds of different fields into a single comprehensible system, right? If we, I mean, in our imaginations, we have ideas like the person who takes like a liberal arts degree or, you know, studies liberally or the Renaissance man or something like that, right? Who has and is able to